Hi, my name is Vashon Ray, 20 class 2024, Dartmouth College, and I'm here with.
Willie Bogan, class of 1971.
And I'm working with the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Program here at Dartmouth College. Today is Thursday, October 28th, 8:35 p.m. I am in Top Lift Hall at Dartmouth College, and Mr. Willie Bogan is
I'm in Oakland, California.
and I want to officially initially thank you personally for being here, and also on behalf of the program.
My pleasure.
Right, so my first question is, where did you grow up? What was your childhood like?
So I was born in Greenville, Alabama. My parents were farmers in Alabama, and when I was about 2 years old, they moved to Michigan, where my dad was able to find a job in the factories. This was post-World War II, and there was a massive migration of Black folks from the South to the North, and my parents and my family were part of that migration. So we grew up in a little town in Michigan called Albion. And I had six brothers and two sisters. As I said, my dad worked in a factory and supporting. Or building parts for the cars that were assembled in Detroit. In Michigan, the auto industry was the biggest industry. So we were all part of that, the beneficiaries of the auto industry in Michigan. It was a very modest, my dad made a very modest income, but thankfully, we were able to keep a roof over our heads, and we had food. And from our standpoint, it was a great childhood. It was a little town. We had a lot of freedom. We essentially didn't have to come in until curfew, which was 10 o'clock at night. And we played during the summer. We played baseball and. That was our first sport and first love. It was a very supportive town. Even when I was playing Little League in Albion, you would get your name in the paper for doing for certain accomplishments like pitching a no-hitter or getting so many hits. And what I found is that that was very reinforcing, that it helped to build confidence. It was a community that was very nurturing. And so I felt like I was, even though it was a small town, I felt like I was somebody. And it also was a place which fostered dreams. And I envision myself playing sports at a higher level. I envision myself going to college. One significant thing about our hometown was that it was also a college town. So we had a lot of professor kids that went to school with us, and it elevated the level of competition in the classroom. So it was all in all, it was a very very happy childhood.
You mentioned sports being like a very intricate part of your childhood, being like some like a centerpiece, something you value. How did sports lead you to college for the ones who don't know you?
So my story is that, I played football, basketball, and I ran track through high school. And football probably was my best sport, although I was very, in terms of team sports, although I was a very good track athlete. I ran the 400 meters as well as, doing the 400 meter relay and some of the other relays. But football was, in terms of team sports, was the sport that was my better sport. And I was thinking about going to college, perhaps in the Midwest, where we lived, because we were from a small town. I didn't, I wasn't going to get interest from big schools like Michigan or Michigan State. So I was thinking about maybe the next level down. And one day I got a call from Dartmouth. It was either a call or a letter, I can't remember, but they were interested in meeting me at a recruiting event in Detroit. And the way that happened was that one of my football coaches responded to a questionnaire from Bob Blackman, who was the head coach at the time, became a legendary coach at Dartmouth. And Bob Blackman was scouring the country, going a little bit deeper than schools like Michigan State had to go, just to find student athletes that might be able to compete at Dartmouth. And he had sent out a questionnaire across the country to high school coaches. And I didn't even know, but my coach responded to one of the questionnaires and indicated that I was a person that could compete academically and athletically at a place like Dartmouth. And so that's how it all began. It was because one of my coaches had enough faith in me, belief in me, that he was willing to put my name down and be an advocate for me. And one of the lessons I learned from that is that sometimes people around you who know you can envision things for your life that you don't necessarily envision for yourself. And that had a tremendous impact on my trajectory.
Can you mention that coach by name?
I can't remember which one it would have been, but it would have either been Coach Faust, Faust, or Coach Mullenkamp, I believe. One of those two. And I did get some attention from other small schools, most and also from the Naval Academy. I was recruited by the Naval Academy, but and I was admitted. I went through the whole process of getting a congressional appointment and all of that, and it was very, very alluring. My parents could envision me in that naval uniform, and you may even know Lee Corso. He's still on Sports Center on game day on Sunday, on Saturdays. Mm-hmm. He actually came to my house. He was with Navy at the time. He was a young coach with Navy. And he, you know, this was a recruiting trip, and he met me and my parents at my, at our house. And he really did a good selling job on them. And it really was a very tempting opportunity. But the bottom line was that we were, this was a period of Vietnam War. And it was very likely that if I'd gone to the Naval Academy, I was going to have to go over to Vietnam. And I really, you know, I really admired all the people who did that, but I did not, I couldn't see myself there because I didn't really know what that war was all about. Anyway, that was one of the other options I had, but I took a recruiting trip to Dartmouth. It was one of those, it was one of those beautiful weekends at Dartmouth where they had invited sister schools in for the weekend. And at the time, Vashon, it was all male. So that was a really big, big thing. And it was just a, you know, I just had a really good time and decided that I couldn't pass up the opportunity to go to an Ivy League institution because I knew how prestigious it was and what a difference it could make in my life.
So pretty sure like the parents are like pretty proud of you, like you're getting Ivy League attention. Could you tell, and from my knowledge, also know about the Rhodes Scholarship that you received. Could you briefly tell me about that?
Yes. So one of the things that Dartmouth did for me was that it broadened my horizons. It made me feel that I could accomplish a lot more, and that many doors would open for me because of the foundation I was getting at Dartmouth. And so in my senior year, I'm sorry, my I think it was my sophomore year, I read in the Dartmouth newspaper that what is his name? He was the Treasury Secretary. Anyway, he had received a Rhodes Scholarship. And I didn't know necessarily at the time what that was all about. I did a little research, and I found that it would give the winner opportunity to go to study at Oxford University, and that the qualifications were being a good student, excelling in academics, of course, being sports, having sports experience, and being a community leader. And those were all things that I, that was part of my experience at Dartmouth. And so I began to think that as a possibility for myself. And so I applied in my senior year. I went back to, you can either apply in the state where you go to school, the state where you reside, where your residence is. And so I went back to Michigan, that area, and went through the process and was selected, and ended up being one of 32 Rhodes Scholars selected from the United States that year. And interestingly, this was a time when people were becoming aware of some of the inequities and in education and other areas of our lives in the United States. And I think there was a special attention being given to trying to identify minority students who could qualify. And in that, in my year, there were five Black Rhodes Scholars. And I'm not sure we've ever had that many since. We may have, but that was really an extraordinary number, 5 out of 32. So I went to, so that allowed me to study in Oxford for 2 years. And Bachchan, if I'd just like to mention one thing, because this is a story that I like to tell because it puts it in context again in terms of what was going on in our lives at that time. And so part of the experience as a Rhodes Scholar at that time was that you would, All right, so I just wanted to emphasize, there were 5 out of 32 Blacks who were Rhodes Scholars that year, an extraordinary number. And part of the Rhodes tradition was that we would all meet in New York before our first year at Oxford. And we would get on this big boat. At that time was the Queen Elizabeth II, or they called it the QE2. And we would have a sailing party. We would sail together over to to Oxford. And well, it was just kind of coincidental that when we were sailing, we gathered with some other folks on the ship, and we met Roy Wilkins, who was the president of the NAACP at that time. And when he learned that there were five Black Rhodes Scholars on that ship, he was overjoyed because he knew in his heart that it was the work that he and others had done, which had laid the groundwork for that opportunity for us. So that's something that's always stuck in my head, how just happy, how pleased that he was to see that accomplishment.
You spoke about one of the requirements for being a Rhodes Scholar, being a community leader. So could you talk about how you were a community leader at Dartmouth campus?
Yeah. And, this was not I wasn't into necessarily the political scene and all of that, but I think it was more of leadership by example, by being a committed student and a committed athlete and achieving at that level. And that as a result, there were other people in our community that looked up to me. In fact, they will tell me now, I didn't necessarily realize it so much then, but what a role model I was for them, some of the underclassmen especially. But, I did get into a situation where as a group, Black students at Dartmouth, we had a confrontation with we had a confrontation as a result of the college inviting William Shockley to the college, and William Shockley was believed in white superiority, and he believed that Blacks were inherently inferior. And so we, as a group, and I was part of that leadership group for that particular event, decided that we had to do something to make it clear that it was not acceptable for him to come on our campus, our home, and talk about our inferiority. So we basically clapped him down so that he couldn't speak. And I was, my only sort of mark on my record at Dartmouth was that I was put on probation, I think, as a result of that. In retrospect, it had been a different time, I don't think that punishment would have been meted out, because they were coming, Dartmouth was allowing somebody to come into our home and to make us feel, to make us feel inferior. Yeah, and in some ways, I think not only was that punishment inappropriate, but that really the college owed us an apology for doing what they did.
Yeah, I think I read up on that. And they was talking about the Judicial Advisory Committee.
Yeah, right. That must have been a committee put us on probation. They had the ones that they could identify. Mm-hmm. And I was identifiable because I was a well recognized football player.
So you were involved in the protest that was on Dartmouth campus. Are you familiar with George Wallace coming to campus?
I am, although I think that happened the year before I arrived at Dartmouth. I think it may have been the spring before I arrived at Dartmouth. But I've heard, of course, I've heard a lot about that as well.
Yeah, I understand that on the flip side, there has been people who are like pro-Black, like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. Was there any like word around them, or like things being said about them, or like not even just things being said, like feelings or like experiences involving them?
Well, I know that at the time, Martin Luther King had a broad following, even among people who were perhaps more militant than Martin Luther King advocated. There was a great respect for him. And I know that was the case at Dartmouth and across the country and probably other colleges as well. He was such a powerful figure. I mean, in terms of his ability to, as an orator, his ability to arouse people and to go to the heart of what is right and decent, and convict people about what is right and decent. And he was just a brilliant man. So there was a lot of respect for him. But I also know that there was a more militant component to the among the Black folks at Dartmouth, and Malcolm X certainly had a lot of respect a lot of respect from those people, because I think a lot of folks believe that we needed to do more than march. It might be necessary to do more than just march in order to bring about equality.
Well, thank you for.
Oh, and I would say too, I remember vividly, it was in 1968. I was just a sophomore. No, yes, 1960. It was the winter of 68. So I think I was just a freshman, my freshman year. And he was assassinated. Martin Luther King was assassinated. And I remember how walking around the campus, around the green, and I just heard the news, and I was really, I felt alone. I felt like they had taken away hope from us. And it was a very somber moment for me. And I remember just feeling that while I was at Dartmouth. It was a great sense of loss.
Thank you for speaking on that. And I also wanted to ask about some organizations, like Black organizations, that not that if you are involved in, like any of them that you can name.
You know, other than the Afro-Am, when I was on campus, that was the only one that I was involved in. I really, and there, obviously there were other organizations that were around at that time, like the Black Panthers, but I was not involved in any of those. And part of it was, there's only so much you can do as a student. And I realized my primary job was to be a good student and to prepare myself for the future. And so I did not get distracted by some of those other organizations.
Could you tell me about your involvement, like your experiences with the Afro-American Society?
Yeah. So from my vantage point, and the Afro-Am was also the organization that really was the group that organized the protest against William Shockley. Would have been probably the group that organized the protest against George Wallace. So it was very politically aware. And it also was also the organization that would organize, I guess there was a protest against the Dartmouth administration itself. And I think I was away from campus at during one of my terms abroad, or I had a term in Mississippi where I taught. So I don't think I was there for that, but that Afro-Am was very politically minded and was at the core of those protests. But more fundamentally, it was a social group. It was where we would go and we would hang out and we would just have a good time with one another. It was a support group for the Blacks on campus. And it was, you know, sometimes we felt isolated as a group, and so it was a way of dealing with that isolation.
So I know you guys protested and were involved in like political things, but what were some of the, like, based on my research, I've seen that you guys made things such as the Black Arts Festival, like the Black Praxis. Could you, like, if you have any knowledge on that, could you speak on that?
Again, I think for me, other than, what I've already spoken about, my involvement was pretty much limited, was pretty much limited to that. I know that we did some artsy things and probably were involved in bringing certain people onto campus. I personally, I think I benefited from that in terms of some of the people that came onto campus. But I wasn't personally involved in bringing that about.
Could you tell me about any Black professors that you guys have on campus, or like any classes that you took? Because I know in 1969, you guys had like an or people like a revision you guys wanted for a Black major or Black studies. Could you tell me about how you guys started influencing teachers and also your classes?
At that particular time, my recollection is the only Black professor was a professor named Errol Hill, Errol, I think it was. Errol Hill. And fortunately for us, he was very much interested in our having a good experience at Dartmouth. He was, and so I remember him inviting us over to his home in Hanover. Just being a again, a support to us. But I, quite frankly, I can't remember anyone else at the time that we had. I think the certainly the there was a lot of buzz about the need for Black professors. And I know that the Afro-Am would have been, again, at the center of that that effort to make the administration aware of the importance of bringing Black professors onto campus. But we didn't get to experience much of that. Again, I can only remember the one.
Were you able to take partake in any Black based courses like Afro-American courses?
I didn't, but I remember some courses that allowed you to take a bent towards the African American perspective. And one of them was just a history course. And it was at Dartmouth in during those history courses that I became immersed in the study of slavery and what vicious institution it was in the United States. And I remember one author describing it as the most, and I don't forget the exact term, but essentially the most vicious form of slavery in the world. So it was, and it was through that that I began to understand our history and how that history continued to impact our lives. I remember I remember having a debate in one of the history courses, and one African-American student was taking the position that we had overcome that slavery and that we were not essentially tied down by the institution going forward, this institution of slavery. And I remember, you know, my point of view was, it was so destructive as an institution that it was impossible for us to overcome it in such a short period of time. And indeed, I think it's one of those things that has manifestations in our history. I mean, throughout our history, through this present day, you can trace back. Oh, let me see. I just lost your. Okay. I mean, I think you can trace back a lot of things, educational inequalities and self-prejudices that Black people experience. You trace a lot of that back to slavery. And I remember another course, I think it was a literature course of some sort. And we were asked to write a play as part of our work. And my play, again, it just focused on the Black experience. And it was about a young man, much like myself, and his father, much like my dad, and how angry the young man was because his father, who was, you know, a great individual, but he wasn't angry about the things that he had, he wasn't overtly angry. He never expressed anger about the things he had to experience in the South. And as a boy, as a young man, where they still called him boy. And and even in Michigan, where we grew up, the things that, you know, he might have had to experience in the factory where he worked, you know, being relegated to certain jobs. And he wasn't, you know, he never expressed anger about that. And this play, one of the things I remember about the play I wrote was that the young man said that he was angry, not just for himself, but he was angry for his father as well.
And for this play, did you have to like present it or?
No, we didn't. It was just a written play.
So did you take this like during your freshman?
It would have been later on. The freshman courses were pretty mapped out. So it would have been, you know, perhaps my junior year, something like that.
Oh, okay. So
maybe even senior year, but it was later on.
What year was it that you and your team, football team, went undefeated? Could you tell me about the year that your team went undefeated?
Yeah. So that was the 1970 football season, and it followed. The 1969 season, of course, but in the 69 season, we had gone undefeated until the last game, which was against Princeton. And Princeton, I must confess, they handled us pretty well. And it left a very bitter taste in our mouths. And so when we I mean, we realized how difficult it is to run the table, but we also realized when you get that close, you don't want to lose the opportunity. So we committed ourselves during the off season. Our rally cry was beat Princeton, remember Princeton, you know, that sort of thing. I know personally, as I trained during the summer, that was on my mind. And we got a second chance my senior year to try to run the table. Princeton was one of our earlier games. Maybe, let's see, what was it?
Yeah, you could. You could put it in the camera. So.
Yeah. So.
Could you tell me what you have?
Yeah, this is the trophy for the 1970 team, which was undefeated.
Could you hold it one more time, please?
Yeah, this is the trophy for our undefeated 1970 team. And we beat Princeton the third game, and we beat them 38-0. Let me see if I got that right. Right, we beat Princeton 38-0, and we were such a dominant team that year. We scored 311 points against our opponents, and we allowed 42 points. We had 6 shutouts that year. The last 4 games we played were shutouts, including Yale and Cornell. And until we beat them, they were one of the highly touted teams, not only in the East, but in the country. And we beat Cornell, which had the runner-up to the Heisman Trophy. I believe it was his senior year, but he had built quite a legacy already by his junior year, the year we played him. And he was running, you know, he was rushing for, you know, a couple hundred yards sometimes a game, and we held him to 60 yards. So it was a very dominant defense. We were committed, we were focused, and we had enough talent to pull it off. Not only were we undefeated, but we won the Lambert Trophy, which at the time was for the team with the best record in the East, which was largely essentially regarded as the best team in the East. And one of the stories in the Dartmouth lore is that Joe Paterno, the coach at Penn State, challenged our coach Bob Blackman to an off-season game because he just couldn't believe that an Ivy League school could compete with the likes of a Penn State, even though we had a superior record. And what our coach Blackman replied, and this is kind of legendary now, is that Coach Paterno knows that Dartmouth teams, Ivy League teams, could not play postseason games as a team. But if we could, we'd want to play a team with a better record than Penn State. And so we've often recited that story because it was so, you know, it was so clever, and it was such a great way to respond to a challenge. But we were also ranked 14th in the country that year. And that was ahead of, you know, big time schools like SC.
So could you tell me about like the atmosphere of the team? I'm familiar with your nickname, Killer Bee, Killer Bees. Tell
Yeah, the
me
Killer
about
Bees.
the
Well,
atmosphere and not just the deep like the defense. You could specify them, but could you tell me about the atmosphere of the whole team?
I mean, I can say that we were truly a team. In fact, when I look back now, those are the guys, offense and defense, that were the closest to me at Dartmouth. I didn't realize it at the time, but we spent so much time together, being in the trenches together, that we did form a real bond. And we were united by that singular purpose of not letting the undefeated season get away from us again. So we were friends as well as teammates. They were you'll hear if you listen to some of the guys on the team, they will tell you that it was a group that liked to have fun. It was sometimes an irreverent group. They did things that weren't just let me put this that might have been a little mischievous. So we had a lot of fun together. And being on the defensive side, I can say that I had a great respect for the guys on the offensive side. I knew I you know I never had a doubt that they were going to do their job. And just having that confidence that everybody was pulling the oar together. And it was really an extraordinary experience to the point where and we've just had our 50th reunion, although I didn't attend personally, but we had a lot of Zoom meetings and email exchanges and so on about those years. And you can tell you can tell from those emails and remembrances how close-knit the team was, and that it was one of the most significant experiences in each of our lives.
Well, yeah, thank you for kind of touching on your experience at Dartmouth. If you have any thing else that you would like to tell me about, like your favorite experience at Dartmouth, one of your worst experiences, also.
So certainly the football experience I would have to count as the favorite experience, especially that 1970 team. And you have to remember that Dartmouth at that time, I mean, Dartmouth. I mean, it's isolated, right? I mean, you're in the middle of New Hampshire and it's a small town and there's not a lot going on around there. So having something like football to hold on to, to allow me to get out and visit the other Ivy League schools and other schools, that was really huge. I mean, it added a whole new dimension to my experience at Dartmouth. But one of the other great things about Dartmouth, and I alluded to this earlier, was that it had a wonderful study abroad program. And I studied as a Spanish major. I studied in San Jose, Costa Rica, at the university there for 3 months, And I studied at the University of Salamanca in Salamanca, Spain for 3 months. So each of those was a term. And then as part of another program that Dartmouth had, I spent 3 months teaching at a school in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And it was those experiences that really increased my worldview and made me a person that was more aware of the world around me. So that those 3 terms were some of the greatest times that I, and most significant times that I had at Dartmouth. In terms of the low points, Dartmouth was all male at the time, and we were, as Blacks, we were not, we weren't well represented there. And it just was a lonely place many, many times. And I think that's why, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, it was almost, we took it very, and I took it very personally that, and it was amplified being in a place where you already felt so alone. And so that was, that was the biggest challenge about Dartmouth, the long winters, being in Hanover, and without a real social structure around you, other than the brotherhood that we developed.
Also was wondering, I know you were there before co-ed, but did you get a chance to experience like the incoming or like the first women on the campus?
When my senior year, they had started bringing in some women on sort of like an exchange program. So they may have finished their senior year at Dartmouth. I don't think they got Dartmouth degrees at that time, but there were women who were on campus my senior year. But you have to think about, I can't remember how many it was, but let's say there were 100 among 800 guys, which was the typical class size at the time, 800 per class. That was a very small percentage. And so it even that didn't seem real. And I must confess, I don't think I may have interacted with a couple, but I really didn't know them. So it didn't seem to affect my experience.
Okay. If you have any like closing remarks, anything, presented me a great interview. You talked a lot about things that you experienced and kind of touched on some of the Black outlook or like the outlook a Black student will have, especially a student athlete during your time. Also being like emphasis on student, because I know you spent a lot of time studying in the library.
Yes.
Do you have any closing remarks? You could say them now.
I would just say that, I still believe, we talked about, how lonely it could be. And one of the things that most of us realized at the time is that even so, having the opportunity to go to Dartmouth was a price we were willing to pay for. And because we knew that it was going to make a difference in our lives. So during those difficult times, some of us might have thought about, how whether we would want to continue that challenges, but only for a moment, because we knew that quitting was not an option. That we needed to continue this journey in order to position ourselves for success. And so we always view Dartmouth as a foundation for that future success. And indeed it was.
Well, also again, want to thank you for presenting your time and also your experiences. That'll conclude our interview. I'm just gonna stop sharing.